You're tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us at 716-245-5FFM. Hello and welcome, everybody, to the First Few Moments podcast, your bi-weekly podcast about managing your scene, where we discuss safety, management, triage, and care. My name is Kyle David Bates, and I am your host tonight. And we're going to kind of rehash a topic we kind of started over on our last episode with Santa Claus and crashing and dealing with the media. We got into a really good discussion. I wanted to kind of expand that, especially in terms of using social media for that. So we have a great panel tonight. I want to first introduce Mr. Greg Freeze. How are you?
I'm well, Kyle. I was looking for that unmute button.
So where are you tonight? You're not in Wisconsin, are you?
No, I'm in Clinton, Mississippi. I've been at the headquarters for the National Association of EMTs for the last couple of days. So I'm working with a group of subject matter experts that are developing a new NAEMT course called the Safety Course, and it's the whole emphasis on it is EMS practitioner safety, and it's going to be a one-day course that they're going to teach for the first time at EMS Today in Baltimore the start of March, and it's a really exciting curriculum that this group of EMS safety experts from around the country have put together. I'm working in a instructional design capacity, and you've had a role in the project as well, and I'm really excited to see this thing come together, and I think it's really going to be something unique and powerful for EMS as, you know, we do things to work on our safety culture in EMS. So I look for more coming out about that from NAEMT and at EMS Today.
Absolutely. I've seen parts of it, you know, and I'm looking forward to seeing that program. I got to ask you, I saw it on Twitter. How's your blow boy?
It was pretty good. We went to this place called the New Orleans Grill for lunch today, and I had gumbo and a crab po' boy, and I was very happy. And actually, we busted their chops a little bit because yesterday they're like, oh, you know, Applebee's isn't far, and we had lunch yesterday at Applebee's, which was fine. And then today we went to the New Orleans Grill, and we all loved it so much. And we're like, wait, well, how come yesterday you sent us to Applebee's and not, you know, we would have eaten every meal at the New Orleans Grill.
I've always learned, go to the local places.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Well, Greg, thank you for coming on tonight.
Happy to be here.
And your partner in crime over at PIO Social Media, Mr. David Koenig, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, sir?
Good. Have you been dug out from the snowfall?
Yes, been, well, you know, I was one of the fortunate ones. I never actually got buried in, although I did end up hunkering down for the night about a bar away from my actual home. So, yeah, I was one of the lucky ones. I had to unstick myself a couple times, but no, I never actually got buried. But we are preparing for tomorrow's thunderous 3 to 6 inches, which everyone is expecting to turn into 18.
and you know, you have no empathy from our side of the state. You realize that?
No, and nor would I expect empathy. You know, I mean, it's really amazing. You know, New York City, for whatever reason, they get an inch of snow, and oh wow, snow day. You know, and suddenly people lose their driving ability and stuff, and you know, yeah, the low riding rims look really great during the summer. Don't work so well during the winter with snow. So, yeah,
it's kind of like being when I was down in Maryland. You know, they just threaten snow and everything closes.
Right, yeah. No place ever actually really closes. They just pull out the blankets and, you know, hope for the best. But yeah, no, it's amazing what happens with just 1 or 2 inches. So we are definitely gearing up for the worst. Sanitation are already being manned, even though it is thus far a clear sky.
So basically, they went from one extreme to the other.
Yep, pretty much. Typical knee-jerk reaction.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Also from that hit with that nor'easter, Mr. Scott Keir.
How are you, sir? David, I don't want you to feel bad. Kyle will tell you they have hikes uphill both ways up in Buffalo. There's nothing, no such thing as a downhill walk or anything like that.
And we had to kill a polar bear.
Yes.
You were just waiting to use that, weren't you?
Oh my goodness, and I screwed it up. That's the
and you're
part of
so
it.
And you're so upset that I didn't make garage that night. Well, Scott, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
From the Great White North, another partner in crime in the first few moments, Mr. Steve Murphy.
Hey, Kyle, how you doing tonight?
Good. How are you up there in Dauphin County?
Well, we're doing all right. We don't have 18 inches of snow, but we might have by morning.
Now, Steve, I think I want you to kind of give a little bit of background specifically for this podcast about your current position and how you kind of bring something to tonight's episode.
All right. Well, as the emergency management coordinator for the county, one of my many responsibilities is, of course, emergency information. And since coming up here, I've really been looking at better utilizing social media, and we've been playing with a few things and kind of testing stuff out. So I'm pretty anxious to hear what everybody has to say. I'm thrilled to share some of the information and some of the things we've discovered tonight, and I'm really looking forward to just getting into this topic.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Steve. And last but not least, the person who has the emergency broadcast signal as a ringtone on his phone, Mr. Rick Rosati.
Now, why did you have to go and say that? Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much, Kyle.
I think it fit perfect in tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's get to it. When we deal with motor vehicle crashes, we deal with road closures, we may deal with hazardous materials, we may deal with chickens and cows and mayhem and everything like this. And whether it be a high-profile individual that's involved in the accident or just a high-profile accident or not, there is potential for media coverage on that. And we kind of discussed in our last episode that you have to kind of make friends with the media. So let's just start with that aspect. Let's talk about what is the public information officer, or Steve, more accurately up in Canada, it's the emergency information officer, correct?
That's correct. When we adopted the incident management system up here, we looked at the role of the PIO, and some folks struggled because that term led them to believe that there was public information, then there was information we were keeping for ourselves. So they changed it up to EIO, Emergency Information Officer. It's also part of the chorus for a great nursery rhyme, but we'll leave that alone.
When should we even consider a PIO? Or EIO?
Always. Let's face it, there's going to be those large incidents where definitely there will be media attention. But you know, the smaller incidents, even things like road closures for a typical motor vehicle collision, getting those out on Twitter, letting the folks that follow you know that there's an incident, it helps better with traffic management. It may reroute or divert some traffic around the scene, make it a little bit easier on the crew. There's no time really that you shouldn't share emergency information with the public.
David, you guys kind of specialize in social media and the use of sharing information. What have you guys found?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty safe to say that if you speak to any PIO of any department, they're going to tell you that their job is to get, you know, the information to the people that need it at the time that they need it. meaning that if it's information regarding a road closure or a hazardous material spill, that the area needs to be avoided, you know, that information needs to go to the public. If there's information being reported about an incident that's perhaps false or misleading, that information needs to be relayed to the incident commander so they can understand, listen, these rumors are out there. Do we want to turn around and clarify, or do we want to, you know, turn around and leave it be for whatever the reason is? You know, and the PIO's job is really kind of a two-way thing. So what we found is that PIOs were finding that repeatedly, whereas traditionally what they would do is perhaps call a news desk when something happened, you know, keep the news desk appraised. Maybe they would send a reporter, maybe they wouldn't. And then they would do an after-action press release that would then go out to all of the news agencies. What they were finding was that more and more there were less reporters showing up on the scene unless it was really a big incident. And the message that, you know, these incidents were still occurring, that there were road closures, still needed to get out. And, you know, they're viewing social media as a viable alternative to the shrinking press room.
What method do you find works the best for using social media? What format?
I think, Kyle, there's a couple ways to look at that. Like, one is you got to sort of feel like what's going to help you connect best with the audiences. You know, I think there's some different audiences in different places. You might find a different audience in Facebook than you might on Twitter. And then you might find an even different audience if you were posting videos on YouTube. And so I think that's one way to look at it is who are you trying to target and where are they? And then as a emergency responder or a PIO, you also got to sort of like what are you comfortable with? And, you know, I feel like Twitter flows at a different speed and maybe has a different community expectation than, say, Facebook might, or just having a blog. And so you got to sort of, like, as you get into it, think of, like, well, what's a good fit for maybe my personality or my skill set, that sort of thing.
I definitely think that there's also something to be said about the type of incident that you're dealing with. You know, an incident such as a car crash, which just happened, you know, in those, you know, first few moments, not to use the title as a cliche, but in those first few moments, what's going to be your quickest route to reach your audience or your subscribers? Twitter is usually everyone's first choice. The problem with Twitter is that the tweet stream, for most users, and I'm pretty sure everybody here has at least seen a tweet stream, I follow 200-something people, so my tweet stream is generally constantly on the move. So if an agency tweets something out, unless I'm looking at the stream at that second, I'm not necessarily going to see it. So agencies need to be aware of, you know, in the initial moments, what's the quickest way? The quickest way is Twitter. It's also the quickest way for the message to not be read. So that's why you might want to turn around and consider doing a quick blog post so that it goes out to their RSS readers and sharing it on a Facebook page. A Facebook page has more staying power in someone's news feed, depending on whether they're looking at recent news or if they're looking at the you know, relevant stories, the top stories, because there are two different settings for the news feeds.
You know, it's interesting that, like, very early into this, David's brought up the importance of monitoring the conversation and following the stream of information. And that's a skill just like writing press releases or answering media questions are skills. It's a skill that you got to practice and hone, and you can't wait until you have a blizzard or a flood or a tornado to all of a sudden be like, oh, we better see what people are saying about ambulance wait times on Twitter. That's something that you should be practicing every day, is how do you use advanced search features on Twitter? How do you set up RSS feeds and Google alerts for keywords relevant to your agency? And that, you know, so then, and also develop relationships with people that if something's going on, you know, you have a relationship with other people that are listening that might say like, hey, I just heard this, read this, saw this. I want to make sure this came across your radar screen because it seems pretty important. That, you know, monitoring piece, it's a practice skill. There's a lot of free and easy ways to do it, but you can't wait until things are bad to get started with it.
We've actually gone ahead and we've added some folks here. As my fault, I overlooked that they were coming on tonight. We have a new folks come on. Patrice Coutier, how are you, sir?
On yourself.
Good. Where are you from? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from Oakville. I am a communicator. I'm a team leader with strategic communications at the Ontario Ministry of Community and Safety and Correctional Services. Basically, that's the ministry that takes care of police, fire, and emergency management, and obviously correctional services for the province of Ontario. I support Emergency Management Ontario in their communications planning and also the delivery of emergency information. So, and specializing in crisis communications, what PIOs should do, and that sort of thing.
Excellent. Well, to get you caught up to speed a little bit, we're talking about motor vehicle crashes, and we're talking about the use of social media. And Greg, I think you were actually in the midst of telling us a little bit about the social media use.
You know, Kyle, as far as like social media use, you know, and this is something that David and I talk about a lot, is just that, you know, it's not just for the actual incident. It's before, during, and after incidents. And I think, you know, it's kind of up to each department, too, to sort of think, like, what's the best way to get started? Is it with prevention messages? Is it with sort of public education messages? Is it just a sort of basic relationship building, you know, for law enforcement? It might be for getting tips and leads. And, you know, I think just that whole listening issue is really important that, you know, because I'm pretty sure Facebook now is the most visited website ahead of Google. And because of that, there's people looking for your agency on Facebook, and they're looking to connect with you and ask you questions. It might be, you know, how do we schedule a CPR class? Or I saw this car crash and it didn't look like anybody was doing anything. Or, you know, is a firefighter available to come to the school and talk to kids about fire safety? And, you know, because people are looking for us there on Facebook, you know, we should be there listening so we can connect with them, because we have an opportunity to maybe do some prevention efforts or, you know, reduce risks, help people be better prepared for the next disaster by connecting there. And, you know, there's also just, I think, just a lot of opportunities for pretty easy successes there as well.
Greg, it's Patrice here. I totally agree with you. The one of the key principles of social media is the conversational aspect of it and the tone you employ. So it goes to two things, really. The stuff you can do on scene even, and, you know, as you deal with a crisis, and to be able to really know what's being said about your organization, and that will have a real impact on your response. If, you know, public perception is bad, that could bring all sorts of pressures on your organization or agency and about, you know, from elected officials and that sort of thing. So you have to have a pretty sound social media monitoring program that allows you to respond to what's been said, that allows you also to identify who key influencers are out there that are perhaps shaping the public's opinion about your agency or a group or even company. And once you've done that, you can engage in real dialogue on those social media platforms and really adopt a conversational tone that will allow you to be heard. And really what it comes down to, especially if you're responding to an emerging incident, is you have, because of social media, the expectation is for immediate response, certainly on the communications point. Even if it's just to say, yeah, we have a plan in place, we're dispatching, you know, the units, we're responding, et cetera, there is a need for an immediate response. Social media gives you the tool to effect that immediate response.
A diverse panel on tonight. We've got commercial EMS, we have fire, we have emergency management on those. How does the PIO differ between those agencies? And who really should take charge of that?
I'm not sure that the PIO differs so much in what their role is. Each PIO is going to bring a certain understanding of their agency or their service to the forefront. As I was, you know, gearing up for tonight's podcast, I was looking at how many times will an EMS agency be utilizing a PIO in a standalone capacity. Typically, EMS, if we have something that we need to get information out to the public in a hurry, we're responding with fire, responding with police or other agencies. So the PIO for the particular EMS agency may very much find themselves working in conjunction with the fire PIO, the emergency management office, the police service, any other responding agencies. So they're working collaboratively, we hope, to make sure that we're getting out a consistent and accurate message to the public. That all needs pre-coordination. That's not going to be thrown together at the moment. That requires a bit of planning and preparation.
Right, Stephen. I don't know how it is in the U.S., but I certainly see it here. The trend is for more unified command type situations, more multiple agencies involved in responses, and partners that, you know, from a few years ago you didn't used to see at on the a scene of incidents. So now, obviously, you need to coordinate the communications response as well. So PIOs will get together and, you know, effect an effective response only if they have built those contacts prior. Obviously, you know, you don't wait until the incident occurs to exchange business cards and do business that way. You have to be prepared, and that is making sure everybody is aware of how everybody else operates and what those key messages that would be shared would be in advance. So, you use social media to come back to that and really communicate very promptly and accurately with all your audiences using all the tools that are at your disposal.
One of the issues, though, that a lot of PIOs are having in the United States is under NIMS, they all get together and go into unified command. It becomes, you know, there's one incident commander and there's one head PIO. Meanwhile, all these other PIOs have their individual agencies and their social media outlets, and there's no clear-cut way, as per NIMS, to turn around and allow them to utilize the social media presences to disseminate the information, because the information is only supposed to come from the informational office of the actual incident. That's something that a lot of PIOs are having problems working into, you know, their county plans when they do turn around and do use unified command. You know, they can turn around and put out that, yes, there's this incident, and you can go to a certain website for information or a certain Twitter stream for information, whoever the lead agency is, but they're unable to turn around and rebroadcast that same information, in their minds, at least.
And that's one of the shortcomings with NIMS, I think, it was developed, first of all, fairly much in a vacuum here in the United States. And it didn't take into account the emerging technologies of social media, just in the budding stages that they were in back when the NIMS document was really formalized and the NIMS cast was really put together. And you're right, the information at a multi-agency response or a disaster response, if you will, is supposed to come from a joint information center. But that being said, it is still reliant and almost assumes that technology will be available to everyone that will be wanting that information. And I think one of the things that has to be examined is how many people will be without their technology, either through loss of power or loss of signal, when that large event happens and we're looking for that information. My number one fear is that while we rely on social media today, it's important to keep those old standby channels of communication with the media open, as it is highly likely, unless there's a catastrophic or cataclysmic event in an area, that the mainstream media will continue to be able to broadcast on things like your regular old transistor radio. Well, we may be wanting for our Twitter and our Facebook because the power happens to be out or we don't have cell signal or whatever the case may be. The one other thing that concerns me about social media on this point is the potential for getting poor information out because it is so open and we can almost impersonate an official response via Twitter or Facebook. So I think I'm kind of dwarfed in my knowledge of social media and public information officer information here with the crowd, but I kind of like to hear somebody discuss some of those issues tonight.
Well, I was going to chime in here that I'm not sure if that's me causing that. No, I was just clicking. I wasn't typing. I was waiting to get in on the conversation. Is that you know, there's an assumption that that PIO is, there's just going to be one PIO, and what we know is a smartphone makes everyone at an incident a PIO, and that's the responders, the patient, that anybody can be updating their Facebook status, sending a tweet, writing a blog post, sending pictures to Flickr, even tending their animals on Farmville while they're waiting to be extricated. And because of that, you know, I think this, you know, concern about, well, who's going to be the official information and we better check with so-and-so and do this policy or that policy. Well, while you're doing all of that, there's plenty of people that are in the midst of it. They're already sending messages out to the world from the actual incident. Again, emphasizing the importance of monitoring. Because the PIO might not be able to do anything other than confirm the reports that the media are receiving from the people.
For social media, and it's how it belongs in disaster or incident management, it's not only for a tool for PIOs, really. Lots and lots of examples are now coming to front where the data mined from social media use because of geotagging and GPS located social media apps, they actually provide very useful situational awareness tools for emergency managers, because so many people talk about the incidents, what they've witnessed and so on. It provides very valuable situational awareness for incident managers. So that's one thing. The only thing, too, to refer to the comment earlier about NIMS and ICS and social media and how the doctrine doesn't reflect the changing technology, the most obvious thing, obviously, is about the doctrine says that all public communications should be approved by the incident commander. Social media is all about being immediate. And if you have to wait an hour or two for the incident commander to approve anything on social media, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, Patrice, I'm going to kind of disagree with about the whole part about social media having to be immediate. Social media doesn't need to be immediate, especially if it's coming from a source that is trusted and known. It helps if it's quick, absolutely. But, you know, Twitter, everybody always think social media and the knee-jerk reaction is either Twitter or Facebook. People forget that, you know, blog posts, blogs are social media. Email itself is social media. These are all methods of communication. And, you know, with Twitter, even though you're sending out a tweet and it's in a stream and you send it out at 12:01 p.m., maybe your subscribers are going to see it, maybe they won't, but that tweet actually is going to remain on your profile page, and each tweet has a permalink. So there is an archive of your social media creation, so to speak, you know, even though those were messages that were sent out immediately, there's definitely a long-lasting archive. So as much as it needs to be quickly and immediate, I think it's more important that, especially if it's coming from an agency, a trusted source of information, it needs to be accurate. And that's something which is an entirely other issue when you talk about, you know, geotagging and geolocation and monitoring certain areas. Is you can do that, you know, the advanced search on Twitter. I use that a lot personally. Used it in the blizzard on Boxing Day, and I'll probably end up using it again tomorrow. You know, what's important to realize about that is, whereas people will turn around and send out messages, you need to weigh, you know, your level of trust in those messages. Is what they're saying something that is entirely possible, or is it something that is completely impossible? And I'll give you a great example of something that seems entirely impossible. You know, a plane has landed on the Hudson, okay? And there was a picture. So right there of the plane on the Hudson, something that seems impossible can definitely be possible, and things that would seem possible, such as there's you know, someone choking on 14th Street, may be a completely false you know, tweet. So it's important to realize that even though you can raise your situational awareness, you need to be able to trust the sources that you're getting your information from. And more importantly, you need to be a trusted source for your community and for your subscribers to receive information.
What about, have you guys heard of the software or site Nixle? N-I-X-L-E?
Yes, I've heard of Nixle. They are... well, look, I'm gonna put it to you this way. The easiest way to reach people is to go where they already are. Twitter has X number of millions of users. Some people say 20, other people say 60, other people say 100. We know Facebook has over 500 million users. That's where our communities already are. Nixle is a, you know, is going to verify your agency, but then it's up to your agency to get you know, the community onto Nixle. That's much easier said than done. And Greg's right. Facebook is now at 600 million users on Facebook. So, you know, there's obviously, that's really where the populations are living online, and that's where we need to make sure that we have established representation and, you know, identity there, because that's where they are going to look for us. They're not going to be looking for us on Nixle unless, you know, they somehow stumble upon it because we're pushing it on Facebook or Twitter.
Now, my population is extremely elderly, and I can tell you I can go in the house all the time and there's no computers. How do we get information out to these folks?
One of the things that I found to be very helpful about both my Twitter and Facebook experiment here is that quite often the first response I get to a post is from our local media, asking for further details, or in some cases just reiterating or redistributing the information that I've posted. But Rick brought it up earlier. What happens when the infrastructure is gone, when we don't have the ability to send, receive messages? What what are the fail-safe ways of getting the message out to the community? That's all something that needs to be included in your emergency information plan.
Well, I think that speaks to the importance of preparation and self-sufficiency and getting those messages out in the years or weeks or months before a disaster to say to people, you know, you need to be ready for potentially 72 hours on your own because, you know, if we've got a significant infrastructure damage, you're not going to hear from us. And, you know, that preparation message. And then I think, you know, that just, you know, I guess we're still looking for the big one, right? Where there was no information that's coming in or out. And I feel like there's been a lot of redundancy built into at least the organization emergency response or emergency communications in the last few years, or at least a lot of people selling really hard redundant systems with backup power and satellite communications. And you know, I'm thinking the agencies are going to be able to broadcast. Whether anybody's going to be able to hear them or not, well, that remains to be seen.
But let's not forget the rural areas. Let's think of the small volunteer fire department that may not run a lot of calls. They may not have a PIO. They may not have an EIO on there. And a lot of times, the person who is speaking with the media happens to be the fire chief. And if he doesn't come on, it seems like the media goes and finds the nearest trailer park to grab the person with the less teeth to interview. So how do we deal with the PIO from that standpoint, from the rural community?
Well, sorry, Greg, go ahead.
I was just muting my microphone, so it's all you.
Okay. If the department or agency has adopted the incident command model or incident management, then that's the way it is. In the absence of filling the position of public information officer, the responsibility falls to the incident commander. So it's his or her choice whether they wish to fill the role and assign somebody to it. In the absence of doing so, they assume the responsibility and the requirement. And I know here in Ontario, it's a legislated requirement. We must get information out to the public. So for those small rural departments, they may or may not have the ability to use a smartphone, BlackBerry, something of that sort, to make a quick post from the scene. If they don't have cellular signal, then they may have to set up a system where maybe dispatch would take care of doing a post, some sort of social media post, or perhaps even a pre-scripted press release, fill in the blanks with location and incident detail and fire that off to local media resources. But again, it comes back to that pre-planning, having an emergency information plan in place, making sure people understand their roles, thorough understanding of the incident management system is essential.
Now, it seems that the relationship between emergency services and the media can be very volatile on that. And it seems, you know, I know a lot of times they'll just put them off in a corner somewhere and say, here, you know, I'll be over, I'll get to you when I get to you. So how do we improve that relationship? And also, what should we, in the scene of a car accident, motor vehicle crash, what should we release? What should we not release?
Well, as far as fostering better relationships, I think that also comes back to pre-planning. We need to be open with these people, and we need to invite them into our world and try and help them understand our world and build that positive relationship so that when you do encounter them in a more stressful time, you might actually have some sort of rapport already built up with the person standing across from you, and you might actually know what to expect from them rather than just kind of shooting from the hip.
Most relationships between first responder agencies and the media are not usually adversarial. These people know each other. The guys on the road, the reporters, or the guy in the cruiser or in the ambulance, they know each other. They've seen each other, so they'll know, you know, what the boundaries are. And I think that relationship goes a long way in help smoothing things out. One thing you brought earlier about the reliability of the cell system, for example. I know there's work being done on that to make sure that if the voice component goes out, that the SMS text messaging and data transmission will still be possible. Another thing also that's being done in the States and a little less in Canada is that whole issue about ensuring that media outlets can still deliver information in case of large-scale disaster, and that's the work done by the Media Reliability and Safety Council. It's a joint FCC and FEMA thing, and it's pretty good exercise of good corporate citizenship by major media players who have agreed to work together. And an example of that was during Katrina, where one of the local papers went to one of its competitors and was able to publish.
Now, just going back to what you said at first there, I would actually disagree that we don't have an adversarial relationship with the media. I wouldn't say it's always adversarial, but I mean, let's face it, the media nowadays thrives on drama and thrives on chaos. And the majority of the news stories that you see hitting the feed wire and the majority of what you see published and reported is not always the most positive stuff. And we kind of suffer because of it.
I have the huge benefit here of having spent a great deal of my adult life in the U.S. and now being here in Canada. I do see a huge difference between in media relations in the two countries. Canadian media doesn't seem to be as aggressive to get the story or be the first to report on something. We have a smaller market, we have smaller advertising, we have fewer media outlets or resources. So and maybe that's all part of it. But from my position as an emergency manager in a small, primarily rural county, my relationships with the media are built up well before the incident, and most recently, the most recent incident we had that brought a lot of media attention to the area, it was that rapport building, that pre-incident work that we did with the media that really made them a partner more so than a nuisance, which is, you know, sometimes how they're perceived.
Yeah, the reaction most times at our incidents when you run into somebody who's carrying a notepad or has a camera on their shoulder, from most of the responders that I see around me is to just kind of be as tight-lipped as possible so as not to be taken out of context somehow or, you know, accidentally say the wrong thing and just steer them in the direction they need to go to get to the PIO and get the information that they need. It's also kind of frowned upon by the upper echelon in all three, fire, EMS, and PD, in my experiences, where they kind of, you know, they don't want you speaking to anybody. They want the people directed to where they need to be.
Well, I'd like to chime in with a couple other points here, if I could, for just a minute. I think we're making the assumption that the media is not going to get their information from any other source. I know there's several media outlets here that follow me and a couple of other responders that I know of on Facebook and Twitter. And I know that because they've contacted for information on various goings on. So I think it's safe to assume that the media will be tuning in to who's ever Twitter stream or who's ever Facebook account and getting their account, whether it's official or not. If I could do one thing with the media ahead of time and all the pre-planning we're talking about, would get the media on board with us, helping us to deliver the message that we want to deliver. And that's just not delivering the message that there is an emergency or a crisis, but how to deliver that so it's listened to better. Oftentimes I find myself, and I know others, not being able to really write consistently to deliver the message or speak consistently to deliver the message in a form in which the public will consume that message the way we want it to. I don't think it's enough to tell people what's going on or tell them what to do. I think in today's day and age, and our disaster management dictates that we have to tell people how to do things as well as what to do.
Well, I don't disagree with you, Rick. I think that being able, you know, in order to tell somebody how to do something or what to do, really requires rapport building. It's a lot easier to get them to kind of play along if you build up that relationship ahead of time. And it's through working with the media and making sure that those folks that wish to know where to find you in your social media presence, that you can really effectively get your message out during difficult times. You know, we started out tonight to talk about, you know, the use of the PIO at, you know, a motor vehicle collision. And, you know, the information I'm getting from you guys, by the way, has been fantastic. And I see another edit to my emergency information plan coming up after this. But getting that information out in a timely manner, getting it out in a consistent and useful manner, I think requires pre-planning. I think it requires a certain level of awareness. And I think one of the most important things is we're concentrating on using our social media or our press releases or whatever the method is during the crisis. But what about day to day? Are we using the same Twitter account or the same Facebook page for that day to day stuff where we're issuing, you know, today's weather forecast or, you know, here's an update, you know, we've hired a new firefighter, that sort of thing. And I think if we're not using it day to day, we're going to be less comfortable with it when it comes time to use it during an emergency.
That's an excellent point.
Clearly that day to day use is really important. And, you know, I appreciate you bringing back the sort of the topic that we started out with is the use of social media by the PIO for motor vehicle collisions. And, you know, most motor vehicle collisions, the actual incident is pretty short. And the PIO needs to notify the public, you know, we've got a collision, this on-ramp is closed, or if you can choose another route to get from A to B, you should do that. And I was thinking a lot about the work that Tim Burrows does in Toronto. Tim is a Toronto police officer, and his Twitter handle is at Traffic Services. But he does a lot of day-to-day use of Twitter, a notification about incidents that are in progress with road closures, also notifications about, you know, here's a you know, we've got a suspect, and you can click on this link to learn more about the person we're looking for to update people about such and such crime, and then also using it to draw attention to also like ongoing campaigns. You know, school starting, watch out for buses and kids by the street, or you know, watch out for cyclists, those sort of things. So. You know, people interested in like how social media might relate, especially to motor vehicle collisions, should follow along with Tim at Traffic Services.
And that's a good point. Ricky, you have to duck out real quickly before you go. Where can we find you?
Yeah, sorry, Kyle. I've got to run. Nope. Mitigationjournal.org is the place to go.
Great. Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night.
Take care of the kid.
Will do.
Okay. So, I mean, these are some things that we really need to look at and address for it. But we mentioned earlier that everyone on scene with a smartphone may end up being a PIO. Can we control that? And how can we control that?
Why would we control it? Just to throw it out there. Of course, we can control it departmentally. We can put procedures in place that says, look, you know, there will be an EIO or PIO designated, and they'll take care of updating the media or the websites. And this way we don't have every firefighter or paramedic stopping to post to their Facebook page, which is probably a good thing. But do we really want to control the public and what they post? I don't think that's ever been what our society is about. Let people post stuff. And if we're monitoring and myself as the emergency manager, I may not be aware of an incident until people start to chat about it and I start to see it on Facebook or Twitter, and then I know something's happening. So you want to be the PIO? Well, self-appointed, go ahead. I'm happy to read what you're going to post.
Well, you know, I don't disagree in terms of the public. I'm talking about responders.
Right, so clearly there's some concerns there of, you know, you got to remember what your first job is and to do that job. And then, you know, I think there's got to be some acknowledgement that this is pretty gray area. And I do an exercise with groups where, you know, I'll say something like, okay, is it okay to post on your Facebook status your patient's name? Yes or no? Of course, everybody says no. And then you kind of step people into the gray zone of, well, what about just letting your Twitter followers know that you're responding to a man with chest pain? You know, yes or no, and that gets pretty gray. Or what about sending a text message to your friend that works at the ER and telling them that you're on scene and you heard the triage officer say there's at least 10 critical patients? You know, so there's this, it can't be a yes or no. It's pretty gray, and that's where, you know, an area that David and I really emphasize is that you got to have some policies and you got to have conversations with your employees, and you got to talk about those gray areas and sort of play those what if conversations out with your employees so they have a feel for what they should or shouldn't do. Because, you know, those of us that live in this sort of like social media world where we share just about everything and very often, it's very hard to turn that off. Just like if you're sending 5,000 text messages a month, it's hard not to text message when you're driving. And so a combination of actually having a policy, doing training and discussing that policy in real world examples with your employees, those two things combined with role modeling social media behaviors. Just like a paramedic's going to look up to that lead paramedic for how they interact with patients and provide treatments, they're going to look up to that lead paramedic or the EMS captain or the EMS chief for how they use social media. And so sort of combine those things, and then you'll get into the ability to actually guide your employees to make good decisions.
Recent example of that comes from England, where this, I think, detective superintendent or something, went to the scene of the suspicious fire. It was a historical building. When he got there, he took a picture from a certain distance and quickly published them. Within minutes, he got calls from the BBC and other major outlets, and he was able to tell them what was going on. And after that, he came back to the office. He said, well, did I make a mistake, or did I really, you know, did something that was out of bounds? But talking to his corporate communications people, they agreed that actually it was a pretty good thing, and now it's become kind of standard procedure for that particular police service in the UK to do that sort of thing wherever operationally feasible. So I think it cannot be overestimated as, you know, an effective tool for on-scene, you know, PIO type of work. Earlier, the mention of, you know, how about using your social media accounts for, you know, ongoing communications? In fact, that's the only way you're going to ensure it's a useful tool during a crisis or an incident, is that if people know that's where they have to go and when they expect to see information when a crisis or incident occurs. And it can be a standalone thing only when there's an incident. A good example of that is that latest Qantas plane, when they lost an engine and had to make an emergency landing. The company was totally, totally unprepared. They had no crisis communications plan in place. One of their people actually confirmed that the plane had crashed. Another one denied that pieces of the aircraft had fallen to the ground. Meanwhile, there were already pictures in the social media and the media outlet in Indonesia with villagers holding pieces of the plane. And most importantly for this topic here, they did not use their social media platforms that they use for like marketing purposes, for example. They did not use those platforms to inform their customers and, you know, family members and so on that there was an incident. In some cases, some of those accounts stayed the same way for 2 or 3 days before they were updated with, you know, information relevant to the incident. So that's a fail on all, you know, nominal aspects of this particular incident.
I think it's important to remember that, you know, your operational requirements as far as responders acting as PIOs for an agency on the scene, like Greg mentioned, you know, they already have jobs to do. So they need to make sure that they're doing those jobs. In the case that Patrice mentioned regarding the police officer, if that's something that they turned around and put into policy, I mean, that's great. That's very forward thinking. If it worked out once, hopefully it continues to work for them. But time and time again, what we're seeing is we're seeing agencies come down with these, you know, very strict policies that really don't do anything other than say you are banned from Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and all social media while at work, and you can't mention the agency that you work for, and you can't post photos of yourself online, and so on and so forth. And they're very ham-fisted policies, very negative, very draconian. And you know, what agencies need to realize is that a lot of times their greatest champions will be their responders. Their responders, you know, are proud of working for an agency, and they're proud to, you know, be doing the job that they're doing, and they want to share that with friends. So any policy that an agency puts into place, while it's completely understandable that, you know, social media may not be in the agency's best interest to be used during work. You know, my own personal agency has a policy of, you know, what happens at work stays at work, as far as social media is concerned, as far as patients. And I mean, that's fine. And, you know, it's understood that, you know, okay, if you turn around and you have a photo of yourself on Facebook or something, you're not going to get fired for it. But obviously, if you post a photo of a patient, or if you do something that's going to violate patient confidentiality, and one of the examples that we use is, like Greg mentioned, the gray area of I'm responding to a chest pain, and then 3 minutes later, you check in on Foursquare at like, in my case, a Dunkin' Donuts. So I've responded to a chest pain. I'm checking in at Dunkin' Donuts. So I have a diagnosis, I have a geolocation, you know, what's the next thing that I'm going to do that could potentially violate HIPAA to identify this patient? And that's a very real possibility of that actually happening, especially when people take photographs now. They are often tagged with geotags, so that could be a patient identifier. And those are all you know, EMS and for fire services that provide EMS concerns primarily, but it could also it's also concerns for the military as well. But the important thing is to have a fair policy that's understandable by all, and most importantly, explained so that everyone understands what is and is not permissible in the agency's viewpoint.
Points, David. So for someone who isn't quite familiar with PIO or EIO, maybe in some of the rural or smaller areas, where would you suggest people learn more about this?
One very basic resource that comes to mind is not too old, fairly recent, basic FEMA resource guide for public information officers. It's got all the basics. That's a pretty good starting point, I would say.
I would recommend PIOsocialmediatraining.com.
I was waiting for that.
I was kind of speechless here. I couldn't believe you guys didn't jump on that a little quicker. You know what, Greg, David, a few months ago I did sign up for your boot camp, and I went through your 10-day program there. What a fantastic resource. It was great. I made sure that that my alternate and our corporate communications folks also signed up. It was a fantastic tool, and you can't beat the price. So good work, guys, and it really opened our eyes to a lot of things and helped us with our emergency information plan.
Well, we really appreciate that feedback, and you know, the emphasis really is on social media and at PIOsocialmediatraining.com. And I think Kyle's question, just about learning to become a PIO, if somebody just is interested in becoming a PIO or a EIO or a BINGO, they, they've got to look to maybe their local emergency academies, fire academies, or state emergency management offices for that sort of general training. But then I think using social media as a PIO, there's some really great examples out there of people that are already engaged. I already mentioned Tim at Traffic Services of different agencies and people that are using social media regularly. Most of them that come to mind are in law enforcement, more so than fire and EMS and even emergency management agencies. But just start looking and seeing what other people are doing, and whether it be Twitter or blogging or Facebook, and pick somewhere to start that feels right for you and your agency, that you don't have to do everything at once. And if you're not sure where to start, start on Facebook, because that's where the eyeballs are.
Very good.
And that sounds good. Now, Patrice mentioned FEMA's guidance document for PIOs, which I recently took a look at. It was really good. But also their independent study course 702, which is the public information officer, another great resource on FEMA's training site, and a good place to get some information. So there's a lot of resources out there. Make the most of them. And by all means, anybody who's on this podcast tonight is always willing to answer questions. So if any of our listeners have any questions or comments, send us an email.
And Steve, I think that's the best way to take us out. We're on about an hour here. And so Steve, where can people find you if they want to get a hold of you?
Well, anybody who's looking to get a hold of me can get me at smurphy@firstfewmoments.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Steve. Scott Keir, where can we find you?
You could probably find me somewhere near my mute button, which I can't find either. You can find me on Twitter at MedicSBK or on my blog, EMS in the New Decade, 2010ems.blogspot.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Scott. David.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at David Koenig, and go check out PIOsocialmediatraining.com. We have free resources on there, and there's going to be some new stuff coming up in January. And anyone can send me an email, Dave@PIOsocialmediatraining.com.
Great, thank you so much, Dave. Patrice, where can we find you?
The easiest way is on Patrice Cloutier at Twitter. And for those interested in how crisis communications plan is put together, a colleague of mine and I have a project, ongoing project on PTSD online, and we're talking about how you build a crisis communications plan.
Great. Patrice, if you send me that in an email, I'll make sure I get it posted up on the website for you.
Sounds good.
And Mr. Greg Freeze, looks like we're going out to... do some more conferences this year.
Yeah, we're doing some more conferences, and I was just going to give a shout out for that David and I have been fortunate to speak about social media and emergency response agencies at a number of conferences, as well as maybe closed group events, we could call them, and people can find our contact information at PIOsocialmediatraining.com. Connect with me on Twitter at GFreeze, and you can also find me at centerlearn.com. My day job has to do with e-learning for emergency responders at centerlearn.com.
Great to have you on, Greg. Thank you so much. And of course, you can find me on Twitter at ImageMedic. You can find me over at KyleDavidBates.com. You can find me at FirstFewMoments.com. Coming up here in February, you can find me in Cordon, Indiana, where Harrison County Hospital, I'll be out there for a day. And then... Steve Murphy, and of course, Rick, skipped out on me. March arrives, and we take first few moments up to Fairbanks, Alaska.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
That'll be the first pilot program of the First Few Moments Managing the Scene course. You can find more information out on firstfewmoments.com. I'm in the middle of writing the course resource manual, and we'll be looking to do a textbook here shortly. So we have a lot of exciting things coming up for First Few Moments. We always encourage your comments. If you have questions, you can call us at the First Few Moments hotline at 716-245-5FFM. That's 5336. You never know. Your comment may end up on an episode. Sometimes you can also email us at kylebates@firstfewmoments.com. So for my esteemed panel and Rick, who I had to leave, my name is Kyle David Bates. Have a good night, and please stay safe out there.